This is disc number two.
I hadn't told him about the super strength, regenerative powers, or skill in the black arts that resulted from eating Unseelie. Only I knew he was currently strong enough to crush me with a single blow. My hands had trembled when I'd forced myself to flush the rest of the uneaten delicacies down the toilet before we'd left. I had set two aside in case of emergency. Halfway out the door, I'd called my own bluff and gone back to flush those two. I'd caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror, white-faced with the strain of denying myself what I so badly wanted, the bliss of strength, safety from my countless enemies roaming the streets of Dublin, not to mention being able to hold my own with barons. I'd clung to the edge of the toilet, watching the chunks of meat swirl around in the porcelain-cradled whirlpool until they had disappeared. We stood on the outskirts of the Temple Bar district, and I was exhausted. I'd been with Jane for 7 long hours, and I didn't like him any better now than before I'd fed him Unseelie and forced him to see what was going on in his world. He didn't like me any better either. In fact, I was pretty sure he was going to hate me for the rest of his life for what I'd made him confront tonight. I had drugged him, he'd insisted, shortly after I'd commenced our little monster tour, given him hallucinogens. He was going to have me arrested for trafficking in narcotics. He was going to have me kicked out of Ireland and sent home to prison. We both knew he wouldn't. It had taken hours of steering him around Dublin, showing him what was in the bars, driving the cabs, and running the vendor stands to get through to him, but I'd finally managed. I'd had to coach him the entire time on how to act, how to sneak looks and not to betray us, unless he wanted to end up as dead as O'Duffy. Regardless of what I might think of his methods of handling me, Inspector Jane was a fine cop, with sound instincts, whether he liked what they were telling him or not. Though he'd insisted none of it was real, he'd nonetheless employed the stealth of 22 years of investigative procedure. He'd regarded the mouthless, sad, wet-eyed monsters, and the leather-winged gargoyles, and the hulking masses of deformed limbs and oozing flesh with the perfect impassivity of a non-believer. He'd slipped up only once, a few minutes ago. I had quickly nulled and stabbed 3 rhino boys in the dark alley we'd been using as a shortcut. Jane stood there, staring down at their gray-limbed bodies, absorbing the lumpy faces with jutting jaws and tusk-like teeth, the beady eyes and elephant skin, the open wounds, revealing pinkish-gray flesh marbled with pus-filled cysts.
"You fed me this?"
he said finally. I shrugged. It was the only way I knew to show you what you needed to see.
"Pieces of these things were in those little sandwiches?"
His voice rose. His ruddy face was pale. "Uh-huh." He looked at me, his Adam's apple convulsing, and for a moment I thought he was going to vomit, but he got it under control.
"Lady, you are one sick fuck."
"Come on, there's one more thing I want you to see," I told him.
"I've seen enough."
"No, you haven't. Not yet." I had saved the worst for last. I concluded our sightseeing tour at the edge of a new dark zone on the north side of the River Liffey that I'd been planning to scout, so I could ink its parameters on the map I'd mailed up on my bedroom wall. "Remember those places you couldn't find on the maps?" I said. "The area next to the bookstore? The ones O'Duffy was checking into? This is what they are." I waved a hand down the street. Jane took a step toward the darkness, and I barked, "Don't leave the light!" He stopped beneath a street lamp and leaned against it. I watched his face as he watched the shade slithering hungrily at the edge of the darkness.
"And you expect me to believe these shadows eat people?"
he finally said tightly. "If you don't believe me, go home, get one of your kids and send them in. See what happens." I didn't feel as cold as I sounded when I said it, but I had to get through to him. And to do that, I needed to hit him where he lived, bring the threat as close to home as I could.
"Don't you ever mention my children to me again," he shouted, turning on me. "Do you hear me? Never!"
"When this wears off," I pointed out, "you'll no longer know where the dark zones are. Your children might walk to school through one and never come home again.
Will you go looking for their piles? Will you even know where to look? Will you die trying? Are you threatening me? Big hands fisting, he bristled toward me. I stood my ground. No, I'm offering to help you. I'm offering you a deal. In a day, give or take a little, you won't be able to see any of this anymore. You won't have any idea where the danger to your family lies, and it's all around you. I can keep you informed. I can tell you where the dark zones are, where the majority of the Unseelie are gathering, and how best to keep your wife and children safe. If it gets really bad, I can tell you when to get out of town and where to go. All I want in exchange is a little information. It's not like I'm asking you to help me commit crimes. I'm asking you to help me try to prevent them. We're on the same side, Inspector. Until tonight, you just didn't know what was on the other side. Now you do. Help me stop what's happening in this city.
This is insane.
Insane or not, it's real. I'd had a hard time accepting that, too. The bridge connecting the sane world to this dark, fae-infested Dublin had taken me many faltering steps to cross. It killed O'Duffy. Will you let it kill you? He looked away and said nothing. At that moment, I knew I'd won. I knew he would call me the next time a crime was radioed in. He would hate every minute of it. He would tell himself he was crazy. But he would make the call, and that was all I needed. I left Jane at the Garda station on Pierce Street, assuring him the vision would wear off soon. As we parted, I saw the same hollow expression in his eyes I sometimes glimpsed in my own. I felt sorry for him. But I needed someone on the inside at the Garda, and now I had him. Besides, if I hadn't opened his eyes tonight and forced him to see what was going on, he'd have ended up dead in a matter of days. He'd been nosing around too much. He'd have spotted an abandoned car down some back alley and walked into a dark zone at night, or whoever'd slit O'Duffy's throat to silence him would have slit Jane's next. He'd been a walking dead man. Now, at least, he had a chance. Chapter 3 I'd die for him. There's nothing else to say. I'd give the last breath in my body and the last hope in my heart to keep him alive. When I thought I was crazy, he came to me and made sense of it all. He helped me understand what I was, showed me how to hunt and hide. He taught me that there are necessary lies. I've been learning a lot about those lately. Every time Matt calls, I get more practice. I'd die for her, too. He's made me see myself differently. He's let me be the woman I always wanted to be. Not the perfect daughter and honor student who feels like she has to do all the right things to make Mom and Dad proud, or the perfect big sister who always tries to set a shining example for Mac and keep the nosy neighbors from ever turning their sharp, gossipy tongues our way. I hate small-town busybodies. I always wanted to be more like Mac. She doesn't do anything she doesn't feel like doing. When people call her lazy and selfish, she doesn't care. She's happy. I wonder if she knows how proud I am of her for that. But things are different now. Here, in Dublin, with him, I can be anyone I want to be. I'm no longer trapped in a small town in the deep south, forced to be the good girl. I'm free. He calls me his queen of the night. He shows me the wonders in this incredible city. He encourages me to find my own way and to choose what I think is right or wrong. And the sex, God, the sex. I never knew what sex was until him. It's not soft music and candlelight, a choice, a deliberate action. It's as involuntary as breathing, and as impossible not to do. It's slammed up against a wall in a dark alley, or flat on my back on cold concrete because I can't stand one more second without him. It's on my hands and knees, dry-mouthed, hard in my throat, waiting for the moment he touches me and I'm alive again. It's punishing and purifying, velvet and violent, and it makes everything else melt away until nothing matters but getting him inside me, and I wouldn't just die for him, I'd kill for him too, like I did tonight, and when I see her tomorrow. I hated him. Oh, I'd hated my sister's murderer before, but now I hated him even more. Here in my white-knuckled hand was proof that the Lord Master had used his dark powers on Alina, turned her into someone she wasn't before killing her. A page torn from her journal, penned in the beautiful, gently sloping hand she'd begun perfecting before I'd even learned to read. A page so unlike Alina that it couldn't have been more obvious he'd brainwashed her, done that voice thing to her he'd done to me the other night in the caves beneath the Burren, when he demanded I give him the amulet and come with him, and I'd been unable to resist or deny him. With the power of a few mere words, he turned me into a mindless automaton. If not for Barons, I would have trundled off behind him, enslaved. But Barons, too, was skilled in the druid power of voice, and had freed me from the Lord Master's spell. I knew my sister. She'd been happy in Ashford. She'd loved being the person she was, bright, successful, and fun, idolized by me and most everyone else in town, the one whose smiling face was always in the newspaper for some honor or another, the one who did everything right. He calls me his Queen of the Night. Queen of the Night, my Petunia. My sister had never wanted to be queen of anything, but if she had, it certainly wouldn't have been the night. It would have been something festive, like Ashford's annual peach and pumpkin parade. She would have worn a shiny orange ribbon and a silver tiara and been on the front page of the Ashford Journal-Constitution the next day. I always wanted to be more like Mac. She'd never once said she wished she was more like me. When people call her lazy and selfish, she doesn't care. Had people really said that about me? Had I been deaf back then, or just too dumb to care? And what she'd written about sex was definitely not my sister. Alina didn't like it doggy style. She'd considered it demeaning. On your hands and knees, babe. Yeah, right, she'd say, and laugh. Up yours. See, not Alina, I told the page. Who had my sister killed the night she'd written this entry? A monster? Or had the Lord Master brainwashed her into killing one of the good guys for him? Who had she been going to see the next day? Had she been planning to kill her, too? Were they humans she'd been killing, or Fae? If they were Fae, how had she been killing them? I had the spear. Danny, a courier for Post-Haste Incorporated, the false front for the organization of she-seers run by the Grand Mistress Rowena, had the sword. Those were the only two weapons I knew of that could kill a Fae. Had Alina discovered some other weapon I didn't know about? Of all the pages in her journal, why had someone sent me this page? Most important and troubling of all, who had sent it to me? Who had my sister's journal? Blaine, Barons, and Rowena all denied ever having met her. Might the Lord Master himself have sent it, thinking, perhaps, in his twisted arrogance, that it would make me find him as attractive as my sister had? As usual, I was adrift in a sea of questions, and if answers were lifeboats, I was in imminent danger of drowning. I picked up the envelope and studied it. Plain, off-white vellum, thick and tasteful enough to have been custom-ordered. Still, it told me nothing. The address, neatly typed in generic font, could have come from any inkjet or laser printer anywhere in the world. Michaela Lane, care of Barons, Books, and Baubles, it said. There was no return address. The only clue it offered was a Dublin postmark, dated yesterday, and that was no clue at all. I sipped my coffee, thinking. I'd gotten up early this morning, dressed, and hurried down from my bedroom on the top floor of the shop so I could stock the new dailies and monthlies, but I'd gotten distracted by the stack of mail piled on the counter. 3 bills into it, I'd found the envelope containing the page from Alina's journal. The pile of mail teetered. The monthlies were still boxed. I closed my eyes and rubbed them. I'd been hunting for my sister's journal, desperate to find it before someone else did, but it was too late. Someone else had gotten to it before me. Someone else was privy to her innermost thoughts and had at their disposal all the knowledge she'd gained since she'd arrived on Ireland's fae-infested shores. What other secrets did her diary contain,
besides unflattering personal insight into me. Had she written about the location of any of the hallows or relics we needed? Did someone else know about the Shisadu and how it was moving around? Were I and my anonymous foe both hoping to track it the same way? The phone began to ring, a local number. I ignored it. Everyone that mattered to me had my cell phone number. Seeing Alina's handwriting, hearing her words spoken aloud in my mind as I'd read them, had left me feeling raw. I was in no mood to talk books to a customer. The phone finally stopped ringing, but after a 3-second pause began again. The third time it started ringing, I picked it up just to shut it up. It was Christian McKelter, wondering what had happened to me the other night and why I hadn't returned any of his calls. I could hardly tell him it was because I'd been a little busy being driven to my knees by a sentient book, watching my murderous employer tote a dead body around, serving addictive, cannibalistic tea to a homicide detective in order to turn him into my informant, then steering him around the city, forcing him to see monsters, and just now reading up on how my sister had loved having sex with the very monster responsible for bringing the rest of the monsters through to our world. No, I was quite certain all of that would only alienate a man I was hoping might prove a valuable source of information. So I offered him a colorful bouquet of lies, and made a new date with him for tonight. By the time I left to go see Christian, Baron still hadn't put in an appearance, and I was glad. I wasn't ready to face him yet. As I locked up the bookstore, I scanned the dark zone. 3 shades towed the edge of the light. The rest slithered and slid in the shadows. Nothing had changed. Their prison of darkness still held. I turned briskly to my left and headed for Trinity College, where Christian worked in the Ancient Languages Department. I'd met him several weeks ago, when Barons had sent me to pick up an envelope from the woman who ran the department. She hadn't been there, but Christian had. Then we'd run into each other a second time, a week ago, in a pub, where he'd stunned me by telling me he'd known my sister and even knew what she and I were. Our conversation had been rudely interrupted by Barons, who'd called to warn me hunters were in the city and told me to return to the bookstore. I'd been planning to call Christian the next day and find out what else he knew, but on my way home, I'd been cornered by hunters and abducted by Malouche, and needless to say, I'd had my hands a little full battling for my life. Then, the other night, the debilitating appearance of the Shisadu had prevented us from meeting again. I was anxious to find out what he knew. I pushed my curls back from my forehead and fluffed them with my fingers. I dressed up again tonight, wound a brilliant silk scarf through my hair and tied it, letting the brightly colored ends trail over my shoulder and drape softly in my cleavage. I was nothing if not determined. At least twice a week I would wear bright, pretty clothes. I was afraid if I didn't, I'd forget who I was. I'd turn into what I felt like. A grungy, weapon-bearing, pissy, resentful, vengeance-hungry bitch. The girl with long blonde hair, perfect makeup and nails might be gone, but I was still pretty. My shoulder-length Arabian night hair curled flatteringly around my face, complementing my green eyes and clear skin. Coupling red lipstick with my darker do made me look older, sexier than I used to. I'd chosen clothes tonight that hugged my curves and showed them to their best advantage. I was wearing a cream skirt with a snug yellow sweater in honor of Alina, beneath a short, stylish cream raincoat that concealed 8 flashlights, 2 knives, and a spear, high heels, and pearls. Dad said the day they'd picked us up from the adoption agency, Alina had been dressed like a sunbeam and I'd been a rainbow. Alina. Her absence in my life was so painful that it was a presence. Grief still kicked me awake in the morning, kept me company all day, and crawled into bed with me at night. Dublin was a constant reminder of her. She was here in every street, in the face of every young co-ed who had no idea what was walking right alongside her, masquerading as human. She was laughing in the pubs and dying later in the dark. She was all the people I couldn't save. I skirted the busy, crack-filled streets of Temple Bar and headed straight for the college. Last night I'd walked through the heavily trafficked tourist zone that boasted over 600 pubs,
But tonight I was in no mood to be reminded that there were only two known weapons that could kill Fay, and hundreds, if not thousands, of Unseelie in the city. My encounter with the Shisadu had sobered me. The sheer evilness of the thing had served as a grim reminder that, although I might have recently triumphed in an against-all-odds type of situation and walked out of it stronger, there was worse in store for me yet. When I arrived at the office that housed the staff of the Ancient Languages Department, Christian met me at the door, looking young, hip and hot in faded jeans, rugged boots, and a sweater, his long dark hair pulled back at his nape in a leather thong. He gave me a charged, appreciative look, making me glad I'd taken care with my appearance. A woman likes to know her efforts are paying off. He took my arm and suggested we go somewhere else.
"They're discussing the budget,"
he advised in a deep, husky brogue, adjusting his stuffed backpack over a well-muscled shoulder. "Don't you need to stay?"
"Nah. Only full-timers have to suffer the meetings. I'm part-time."
He flashed a killer smile that made me stand up straight. Christian was the kind of good-looking that hit you over the head, made you keep stealing second and third glances at him. The 5 o'clock shadow on the strong jaw, the broad shoulders, the flawless dark skin, and the striking tiger eyes. There was an easy grace to his long-limbed body that hinted at maturity beyond his years.
"Besides, it's not a place I'm comfortable talking, and we've got a great deal to talk about, lass."
I hope that meant someone was finally going to tell me something useful about my sister. He led me to a windowless study room off a vending area in the nearly deserted basement of the building. We settled into folding metal chairs, beneath the hum of fluorescent lights, where I imagined Alina might have sat and studied a time or two. I wasted no time asking Christian how he'd met her. I wondered if he'd been one of the boys she dated when she'd first come over, before she'd been brainwashed by the Lord Master. I sure would have. In another life. A normal one.
"She came to the ALD, looking for someone to translate a page of text."
"What kind of text?" I thought instantly of the Shisadu.
"Nothing I could translate. My uncles couldn't either."
I assumed his uncles were linguists and said so. He smiled faintly, as if amused by the question.
"They're historians, after a fashion, knowledgeable about antiquities and such. I've never stumbled across a text they couldn't translate."
"Did you ever find out what it was?"
"My turn, Mac. I've a few questions of my own. What happened to you the other night? Why'd you cry off?"
"I told you. My dad called and we got to talking about Mom and how she's getting worse and I lost track of time. Then by the time I got off the phone, something I ate for dinner wasn't agreeing with me, and I felt so sick I just went to bed."
"Nice try,"
he said dryly.
"Now, tell me the truth."
"I just did."
"No, you didn't. You're lying. I hear it in your voice."
"You can't hear whether I'm lying in my voice," I scoffed. "Body language might tell you a thing or two, but..."
"Yes, I can."
He cut me off with a faintly bitter flash of that killer smile.
"Literally. You lie. I hear it. And I wish I didn't. You have no idea how often people lie. All the bloody time about everything, even stupid things that make no sense to bother lying about. Truth between us, Mac, or nothing at all. Your choice. But don't bother trying to fool me. You can't."
I began to ease off my coat, remembered my arsenal, and thought better of it, settled back in my chair and crossed my legs, one high heel swinging. I searched his face. My God, he was serious. "You really know when people are lying?" He nodded. "Prove it."
"Got a boyfriend?"
"No."
"Is there a man you're interested in?"
"No."
"You're lying."
I stiffened. "I am not."
"Yes, you are. He may not be a boyfriend, but there's some man you're interested in enough that you're thinking about having sex with him."
I glared. "I am not. And you can't possibly know that." He shrugged.
"Sorry, Mac. I hear the truth even when the person isn't admitting it to themselves."
One dark brow lifted.
I don't suppose it might be me.
I blushed. He just made me think it. Us, naked. Wow! I was a perfectly healthy woman, and he was a gorgeous man. No, I said, embarrassed. He laughed, gold eyes glittering.
Lie, a whopper. Gotta love that. Have I told you I'm a big believer in fulfilling a woman's fantasies?
I rolled my eyes. I wasn't thinking it before you said it. You put the thought in my head, and then there it was, and I was thinking it. And that worried me, because I could think of only two other people, and I was using that term loosely about both, that I might have been thinking of having sex with before he'd made me think about having sex with him, and both were terrible choices. This doesn't prove anything.
Guess you'll have to take me on faith, then, until you get to know me. I take you on faith. I don't ask you to prove that you see the fae.
People think about having sex all the time, I said irritably. Are you aware of every time you're thinking about it, and with who?
Bless the saints, no. I wouldn't get anything done. Most of the time it's just background music, you know. Sex, 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 find it, have it, drown in it before more perfectly good sperm die, playing in my head to an easy, sensuous beat. Then somebody like you walks in and it ratchets up to that 9-inch nails song my uncle plays all the time for his wife.
He grimaced.
We leave the castle and go somewhere else when he does that.
Your uncle listens to Trent Reznor? I blinked. You live in a castle? I didn't know which thought was weirder.
Big, drafty, not as impressive as it sounds. And not all my uncles are as cool as Digus. Men want to be him. Women adore him. It's irritating, actually. I never introduce my girlfriends to him.
If he was anything like Christian, I could see why.
Point is, Mac, don't lie to me. I will know, and I won't put up with it.
I pondered his claim. I knew what it was like to be capable of doing something others would consider impossible. I decided to take him at face value and see what came of it. Time would tell. So is it a gift of birth, like me being a she-seer?
You don't think being a she-seer is a gift? Nor is my little problem, and yes, much to my parents' inconvenience, I was born this way. There are necessary lies, or at least kind ones. I never got to hear any of them. I don't get to hear them now.
Alina had said the same thing. Necessary lies. We'll look on the bright side of it. You don't get to hear any lies, but nobody around you gets to tell any either. Do you think it's easy to be around someone that you have to tell the truth to all the... Oh! I drew up short. You don't have many friends, do you? Not if he spoke his mind freely and he looked like the kind of guy that did. He shot me a cool look.
Why'd you cry off last night?
I had a close call with a dark haller, and they make me too sick to function if I get too close. He leaned forward, elbows on his knees, and stared at me with fascination.
Now that was a celestial choir of truth, lass. You saw a dark hollow? Which one?
How do you know about the Dark Hallows? Who are you, and what's your involvement in this? I didn't need any more mystifying men in my life.
How much truth will you give me?
I hesitated only briefly. Of all the men I'd met in Dublin, he seemed the most like me, essentially normal, but afflicted with an unwanted, life-altering talent. As much as I can, if you do the same. He nodded, satisfied, then settled back in his chair.
I come from a clan that, in ancient times, served the Fae.
The Celtae, Christian told me, had once been high druids to the Tuatha De Danann many thousands of years ago, during that brief time in which the Fae had attempted to play nice and to coexist with man. Something had happened that shattered the fragile peace. He skimmed over this part. But whatever it was, it caused Fae and man to go their separate ways, and not amicably.
A compact was negotiated to permit both races to exist on the same planet, but keep the realms separate, and the Kelta were given the duty of performing certain rituals to maintain the walls between them. Over the millennia, they performed them faithfully with few exceptions, and if they failed in some small way, they always managed to make up for it in the nick of time. But in recent years, the rituals stopped going as expected. On those pre-appointed nights of the year when the Kelta were to perform their magic, some other dark magic had risen up and prevented the pledge from being reinforced, and the tithe from being fully paid. Although this other magic hadn't been able to collapse the walls between our worlds, it had seriously weakened them. Christian's uncles believed the walls would not hold through another incomplete ritual. The Queen of the Seelie, Avil, who in the past had always appeared in times of crisis, had yet to be seen, although they'd invoked her by every spell they had at their disposal. I was riveted by the story. The thought that for thousands of years, a clan in the Highlands of Scotland had been protecting mankind from the Fae fascinated me. Especially if they were all like Christian, gorgeous, sexy, self-possessed. It was comforting to know there were other bloodlines out there in the world with special, unusual powers. I wasn't alone in my awareness of what was happening to our world. I'd found someone besides Barons who had more information than me, and he was willing to share it.
"My uncles believe something has happened to the Queen," he said.
"And
as her power diminishes, another's grows. The walls continue to weaken, and if we don't figure out something by the time the next ritual must be performed, they'll come down."
"What'll happen then?" I asked in a hushed voice. "Will the compact be broken?"
"My uncles believe the compact already is broken, that the walls are holding only because of the increase in tithes they keep paying. Fae magic is strange stuff."
He paused then, said tightly,
"At the last rites, we had to use blood, Kelter blood, in a pagan ritual. It's unheard of. We've never used blood before. Uncle Cain knew how to do it. It was dirty magic. I could feel it. What we did was wrong, but it was the only thing we could do."
I understood that feeling. What I'd done to Jane would never sit entirely well with me, but I'd been unable to think of an alternative. It hadn't been dirty magic, just dirty tea. Manipulative, ruthless. But I've begun to understand that you can only afford to play nice when there's not much at stake. "And if the walls come down completely?" I reiterated my earlier question. I wanted to know just how bad things might get.
"When the Fae walked among us before, only the Seelie did. The Unseelie have been imprisoned for so long that mere whispers of myths remain. If the walls come down completely, all the Unseelie will be freed, not just the lower castes that are currently managing to get through somehow. The most powerful of the Unseelie royal houses will escape."
He paused, and when he spoke again his voice was low, urgent.
"Myth equates the heads of those four houses, the Dark Princes, with the four horsemen of the apocalypse."
I knew who they were. Death, pestilence, war, and famine. The Unseelie I'd seen so far were bad enough. I had no desire to ever encounter a royal dark fae.
"It'll get bad, Mac. It'll turn our world into a living nightmare. My uncles believe the Seelie may not be able to re-imprison the Unseelie if they escape."
Was this why everyone was after the Shisadu? Did it contain the spells necessary to imprison the Unseelie? Maybe even keep the walls from coming down in the first place? It would certainly explain why Vlaine and the Queen wanted it, why Alina had wanted me to find it before the Lord Master did. No doubt if he got his hands on it, he'd hurry up and destroy it to make sure no one could ever imprison his army again. I wondered where Barons fit in. Would he really sell it to the highest bidder? I couldn't dwell on the possibility of Unseelie overrunning our world. Keeping my thoughts tightly focused on my goals was the key to keeping my fears in check. "Tell me more about Alina." At my swift change of subject, he looked relieved, and I realized I wasn't the only one who felt like I was charged with an impossible task.
It was no wonder Christian seemed mature beyond his years. He was. He had his own fate-of-the-world issues to deal with.
"I'm sorry, Mac, but I don't have much more to say. I tried to make friends with her. Although my uncles couldn't translate the text, they knew where it had come from, and we needed to know how she'd gotten it. It was a photocopy of a page from an ancient book.
Called the Shisadu. The Beast, I thought, and my soul shivered.
I wondered if you knew about it. What do you know? Do you know where it is?"
I didn't know exactly where it was at the moment, and brandished that thought like a shield when I answered, "No," in case he really was a walking, breathing lie detector. Because he was searching my gaze far too intently for my comfort, I added quickly, "What happened when you tried to make friends with my sister?"
"She rebuffed my efforts. She was deeply involved with someone, and I got the impression he was very possessive. Didn't like her talking to anyone."
"Did you ever meet him?"
"No. I caught a glimpse of him once. Fleeting. Don't remember much, which makes me believe he was fey. They mess with your head if they don't want you to see them."
"Did you tell my sister the stuff you just told me?"
"I didn't get the chance."
"If you never became friends, how did you find out she was a she-seer? How did you find out about me?"
"I followed her a few times,"
he said.
"She was always watching things that weren't there, studying empty spaces. I was raised on stories of she-seers. My family is into old myths and lore. I put two and two together."
"And me?" He shrugged.
"You were poking around Trinity asking about her. Besides, family's a matter of public record, if you know where to look."
With all my enemies, those were records I'd like destroyed. I was grateful my parents were 4,000 miles away.
"Which Dark Hala did you have a close call with last night?"
he asked casually. "The amulet."
"Lie."
"I tested him. The scepter."
"Lie again. And there is no such thing."
"You're right. It was the box," I said heavily.
"I'm waiting for the truth, Mac."
I shrugged. "The Shisadu?" I offered, like I didn't really mean it. He exploded out of his chair.
"What the? Are you kidding me? No, no need to answer that. I know you're not. You said you didn't know where it was."
"I don't know. I saw it in passing."
"Here? In Dublin?"
I nodded. "It's gone. I have no idea where it was taken."
"Who?"
Christian began.
"Hi, guys. What's up?"
Christian's gaze slid past me to the door. He stiffened.
"Hey, man, I didn't hear you come in."
I hadn't either.
"How long have you been standing there?"
"I just opened the door. I thought I heard you in here."
I turned in my chair. The second time he'd spoken, I'd recognized the voice. The dreamy-eyed guy I'd seen in the museum and then run into later on the street the day I'd been interrogated by Inspector Jane was filling the doorway with his dark, dreamy, good looks. He told me he worked at the ALD, but I'd put him out of my mind. Like Christian, in another life, I'd have dated him in a heartbeat. Why, then, had it been Barron's I'd ended up kissing?
"Hey, beautiful girl. Fancy seeing you here. Small world, isn't it?"
"Hey." I blushed a little. I do that when a good-looking guy calls me beautiful, especially now that every time I look in a mirror, I hardly recognize myself. Ironically, when your world comes completely unglued, it's the paste of the everyday meaningless little things that suddenly seem like real gems.
"You two know each other?"
Christian looked baffled. "We've run into each other a time or two," I replied.
"They're looking for you back at the office, Chris,"
said the dreamy-eyed guy.
"Elle wants to talk to you."
"Can't it wait?"
said Christian impatiently. He shrugged.
"She didn't seem to think so. Something about misappropriated funds or something. I told her I'm sure it's just a bookkeeping error, but she's on one."
Christian rolled his eyes.
"That woman is impossible," Will you tell her I'll be there in 5?
Sure, man.
His gaze cut to me.
Is this the boyfriend you meant?
I shook my head.
But you have one.
Dozens, remember? He laughed.
See you around, beautiful girl. 5 minutes, Chris. You know how L gets about you.
Dragging a finger across his throat, he grinned and left. Christian hurried to the door and shut it.
Okay, we've got to talk fast, because I need this job for the time being, and lately L seems to be looking for any reason to fire me. There's something you need to see.
He opened his backpack and pulled out a leather notebook tied with knotted cord.
My uncle sent me to Dublin for a reason, Mac. Well, several. But only one immediately concerns you. I've been watching your employer.
Barron's? Why? What had he learned? Something that might help me sort through my own worries about who and what he was?
My uncles are collectors. Everything they've been trying to collect for the past few years, your employer has been going after too. Some of it he's gotten. Some of it my uncles have gotten. And still other items have gone to a third party.
He withdrew a file from his notebook and handed me a magazine folded open to a page.
Is that Jericho Barron's?
A brief glance was enough. Yes. He was nearly lost in the shadows, standing behind a group of men, but the flash had caught his face at just the right angle to bathe it starkly in light. Though the photo was grainy, there was no mistaking him. Barron's is unusual. He says his ancestry is Basque and Pict. Criminals and barbarians, I'd mocked when he told me. He certainly looks the part.
How old would you say he is?
In this picture?
No, now.
He's 30. I saw it on his driver's license. His birthday was coming up. On Halloween, he'd be 31.
Look at the date on the magazine.
I flipped to the cover. The photo had been taken 17 years ago, which meant he'd been 13 at the time of the photograph, if the date on his driver's license was to be believed. Obviously it wasn't. No 13-year-old boy in the world looked that mature. Christian handed me another magazine, this one featuring a gathering of wealthy socialites at a gala at a British museum. Again, Barron's was unmistakable in it, even half-turned as he was from the camera. Same hair and faultlessly tailored clothing, same expression on the haughty old-world face, a mixture of boredom and predatory amusement. I flipped to the cover. This photo had been taken 41 years ago. I flipped back to the photo and studied it carefully, looking for anomalies. There were none. It was either Barron's, or he had a grandfather who'd been his identical twin, and if this was Barron's in the photo, he was currently 71 years old. Next, Christian passed me a photocopy of a newspaper article with a faded black-and-white photo of a group of uniformed men. Barron's was the only one not wearing a uniform. As was the case in the last two photos, he was angled slightly away, as if trying to slip off before the shot could be snapped. And, as was the case in the last two photos, he didn't look a day older or younger than he did today.
Do you know who that is?
Christian pointed to the big, raw-boned, 30-ish man in the center of the photograph. I shook my head.
Michael Collins. He was a famous Irish revolutionary leader.
So?
He was killed in 1922. This picture was taken 2 months before he died.
I did some rapid math. That would mean Barron's wasn't 71. He was an extremely well-preserved 115. Maybe he had a relative, I offered, with a strong genetic resemblance.
You don't believe that,
he said flatly.
Why do people do that? Say things out loud they don't even remotely believe.
He was right. I didn't believe it. The pictures were too identical. I'd spent enough time with Jericho Barron's that I knew the way his limbs moved, the way he stood, the expressions he wore. It was him in all those pictures. Inside, a part of me went very still. Barron's was old, impossibly old. Being kept alive by gripper possession? Was that possible? Are there more of these? I wondered how far back Christian's uncles had traced him. I wanted to take these photographs with me, slap them against Baron's chest, and demand answers, even though I knew I'd never get any. He glanced at his watch.
Yes, but I have to go.
Let me hold on to these a few days.
No way. My uncles would kill me if Baron's got his hands on them.
I relinquished them reluctantly. I could begin research of my own, now that I knew what to look for. I wasn't sure I needed to. What difference if Barons were 100, 1,000, or several thousand? The point was, he was inhuman. The question was, how bad was whatever he really was?
I'm leaving for Inverness tomorrow, and won't be back for a week. There are things at home I need to take care of. Come and see me next Thursday. I believe you and I can help each other.
He paused, then said,
I believe we may need to help each other, Mac. I think our purposes may be tied together.
I nodded as we walked out, although I had my doubts. I'd been turning into a real bottom liner lately, and regardless of how much Christian might know, or his involvement in maintaining the walls between realms, or how much I might enjoy his company, the bottom line was he was a man who couldn't see the Fae, and that meant, in a fight, he'd be a liability. One more person I'd have to worry about keeping alive. And lately, I was having a hard enough time keeping myself alive. I shouldered past tourists, wound my way between rhino boys and assorted unseely, and was a few blocks from the bookstore, passing one of the countless pubs that characterized Temple Bar, when I glanced in the window, and there she was, Alina, sitting with a group of friends in a low-backed corner snug, tipping back a bottle of beer, lowering it and laughing at something the guy next to her had just said. I closed my eyes. I knew what this was, and he needed to get some new tricks. I opened them and glanced down at myself. At least I wasn't naked. Vlaine, I said, did I ever have a bone to pick with him?
Michaela.
Ignoring the reflection of the tall, erotic, golden creature behind my shoulder, I focused that ancient, alien, she-seer place inside my brain on the illusion. Show me what is true, I demanded. The vision of Alina ruptured with the suddenness of a bubble bursting, revealing a group of boisterous rugby players toasting their latest victory. I turned and was slammed upside the head with Death by Sex Fae. My knees got soft, my nipples got hard, and I wanted sex on the sidewalk, sex bent over that nearby car, sex up against the wall of the pub, and who cared if my naked petunia got smashed up against the window for all to see in the process? Vlaine is a prince from one of the four Seely royal houses, and it's difficult to look at him directly when he's in high glamour. He's gold and bronze, velvet and steel, and his eyes blaze with the stellar grandeur of a wintry night sky. He is so unearthly beautiful that it makes a part of my soul weep. When I look at him, I hunger for things I don't understand. I ache to be touched by him. I'm terrified of his touch. I think sex with him might undo my essential cellular cohesion and shatter me into fragments of a woman that could never be pieced back together again. If Vlaine were a signpost, it would read, "Abandon all personal will, ye who tread here." And while I never thought much about Will back home in Ashford, here I've begun to think it's all I really have to call my own. I tried regarding him with a slightly peripheral vision. It didn't help. My clothing was painfully constricting, and I battled the overwhelming urge to remove it. Fae princes drip such raw eroticism that it provokes a woman's senses beyond anything she was meant to experience, turning her into an aroused animal, willing to do anything for sex. While that might sound like it promises the kinkiest escapades and most incredible orgasms of your life, they don't grasp basic human concepts like death. Time has no meaning to them. They don't need to eat or sleep, and their sexual appetite for human women is enormous, all of which leads to one inevitable outcome. A woman caught in a fae prince's spell usually gets fucked to death. If she survives it, she's Praya, an addict, a void of insatiable sexual need that exists for one purpose, to serve her master.
and that's determined by whoever is currently giving her sex. The first few times I encountered Blaine, I'd begun stripping where I stood. I was getting better at resisting, because I was catching my hand every time it moved to the hem of my sweater before I began pulling it over my head. Still, I wasn't sure how long I could keep it up. "Mute it," I demanded. A slow smile curved his lips.
"I am muted. Whatever you feel is not coming from me."
"You're lying." I briefly visited Christian's charge that I was thinking of having sex with someone. Blaine was not a someone. He was a something.
"I am not. You have made it clear you will not abide my sexing you up. Perhaps you are, how do you humans say it? In heat?"
"We say that about animals, not people."
"Animals, people, what difference?"
"Seely, unseely, what difference?" Silvery flakes crystallized in the air between us, icing the night with royal displeasure.
"The difference is too vast for your puny mind to comprehend."
"Ditto."
"You are not naked, on your hands and knees, offering me your pretty little ass, Michaela, which is what you do when I use the Shiva High on you. Would you like a reminder?"
"Try it, and I'll kill you."
"With what?"
I yanked my hand from the button at the back of my skirt and went for the spear holstered beneath my arm, but it was gone. He'd taken it the last time we'd met, too. I wanted to know how he was doing it. I had to find a way to stop him. He paced a circle around me. By the time he'd completed it, his gaze was as chill as the night air.
"What have you been up to, She-Seer? You smell different."
"I've been using a new moisturizer." Could he smell my recent cannibalization of his race? Though I no longer suffered the dramatic effects of it, did a residue stain my skin as it had tarnished another less tangible part of me? I had eaten unseely, not seely. Would that make a difference to him? I doubted it. The bottom line was I'd eaten Fae to steal the power of the Fae, and I'd just fed it to another human, and I would never admit either of those facts to any Fae. "Like it?" I said brightly.
"You are powerless to defy me, yet stand before me dripping defiance. Why?"
"Maybe I'm not as powerless as you think. What would a bite of seely royalty do to me? I'd find out if I had to. Surely I could null him long enough to sink my teeth in somewhere." The thought was a little too tempting. All that power, mine in one tiny bite. Or 10. I wasn't certain exactly how much I had to eat to get super strength, when I wasn't mortally wounded to begin with. He considered me a moment, then laughed, and the sound made me feel suddenly ebullient, drunk with euphoria. "Stop it," I hissed. "Quit amping up my feelings."
"I am what I am, even when I mute myself, as you say. My presence overwhelms mere humans."
"Fool," I cut him off. "When you were kneeling on the beach in Ferry and touched me, you felt like a man and only a man." That wasn't entirely true, but it had been better than this. He could tone himself way down if he chose. "I know you can do it. If you want my help finding the book, turn it off, and turn it all off, now, and keep it off in the future." I'd picked up a superstition from Danny, the young She-Seer I'd met recently, who'd warned me about casting certain words on the wind I didn't want traced back to me. So now, whenever I spoke of the She-Seer aloud, out in the streets, especially at night, I tried to remember to call it simply the book. Blaine shimmered, flashed brilliant white, then faded and resolidified. I tried not to gawk. Gone were the iridescent robes, the eyes that burned with a thousand stars, the body that radiated the fire of Eros. A man stood before me in faded jeans, a biker jacket, and boots, the sexiest man I'd ever seen. A golden, horny angel stripped of wings. This Blaine I could deal with. This Fey Prince I could keep my clothes on around.
"Walk with me."
He offered his hand.
She, Sia, walk with Fay? My every instinct screamed no.
I'll null you if I touch you. He considered me a moment, as if debating whether to speak. Then he shrugged, but not well. The human gesture only made him look more alien.
Only if you wish, Michaela. The desire to null or the instinct to defend yourself must be present. If you do not desire it, you may touch me.
He paused.
I know of no other Fae who would permit such intimacy and risk. You speak to me of trust. I am giving it to you. Once you touch me, you could alter your intent, and I would be at your mercy.
I liked that. Him at my mercy. I took his hand. It was a man's hand, warm, strong, nothing more. He laced his fingers with mine. I hadn't held hands with anyone in a long time. It felt good.
You spend time in my world,
he said.
Now I will spend time in yours. Show me what it is you care for so deeply that you would die for it. Teach me of human ways, Michaela. Show me why I should care, too.
Teach this ancient creature who, in his most recent incarnation, was over 142,000 years old? Show him why he should care about us? Right. And I was born yesterday. You never stop, do you?
Never stop what?
He said innocently. Trying to seduce. You just switch tactics. I'm not stupid, Blaine. I couldn't teach you to care about us in a million years. But you know what really pisses me off? I shouldn't have to justify our existence to you or any Fae. We were here first. We have the right to this planet. You don't.
If might makes right, we have all the right to this world we need. We could have exterminated your kind long ago.
Why didn't you?
It is complicated.
I'm listening.
It is a long story.
Got all night.
Fae decisions are not for humans to know and understand.
There you go, getting all superior again. You can't fake nice for more than a few seconds.
I am not faking, Michaela. I am trying to know you, to earn your trust.
You could have earned some of my trust by being around when I needed you. Why didn't you save me? I demanded. I'd been scarred by my hellish time beneath the burn in ways I didn't fully understand, and, although my body had healed, and I felt stronger than ever, I wasn't certain I was necessarily the better for it. I almost died. I begged you to come. He stopped abruptly and spun me to face him. Though his body was as warm and solid as mine, his eyes blazed in human fire.
You begged me? Did you cry my name? Pray to me?
I rolled my eyes. Figures, that's what you'd hear. I stabbed him in the chest with a finger. It sent erotic recoils up my arm. Even turned off, he was turning me on. The important part in there is that I almost died.
You are alive. What is the problem?
I suffered horribly, that's the problem. He caught my hand before I could poke him again, turned it up, and grazed his lips across the underside of my wrist, then bit it sharply. I snatched it away, skin stinging.
Such a naked, defenseless wrist,
he said.
How many times have I offered you the cuff of Cruz? Not only would it prevent lesser Unseelie from harming you, with it, you could have summoned me, and I would have saved you. I told you this at our first encounter. I have offered you my protection repeatedly. You have refused me at every turn.
A cuff can be removed. I sounded bitter because I was. I'd learned that lesson the hard way.
Not this.
He closed his mouth, but it was too late. He had slipped. All-powerful Prince Blaine of the Supercilious Fae had slipped. Really? I said dryly. So once it's on me, I'm stuck with it forever. That's the tiny little inconvenient catch you've never happened to mention to me before.
It is for your own safety. As you said, a cuff could be removed. How would that serve you? Better that it cannot be taken off.
Barons and Blaine had both been up to the same trick all along, trying to put their permanent mark on me. Barons had succeeded. I'd be darned if Blaine would. Besides, I was pretty sure Malouche would have cheerfully sawed off my arm to remove the cuff, which made me really glad I hadn't been wearing it. You want me to trust you, Blaine? Give me another way to summon you, a way that costs me nothing. He sneered.
And make a fey prince answerable to a she-seer.
Allow me to put it into perspective for you. I saw the book again the other night and had no way to contact you.
You saw it? When? Where?
How do I summon you?
You dare much, she-seer.
You ask much, fey.
Not as much as I could.
Had I lost a few seconds there, or had he been leaning closer all the time? His mouth was inches from mine. I could feel his breath on my skin. He smelled of exotic, drugging spices. Back off, Blaine, I warned.
I am preparing to give you the way to summon me, human. Stand still for it.
A kiss? Oh, please, I'm not that...
My name on your tongue. I cannot teach you to say it. Humans do not possess the ability to form such sounds. But I can give it to you. With my mouth, I can place it on your tongue. Then you have but to release my name to the wind, and I will appear.
He was so close that the heat of his body was sunshine on my skin. Was nothing simple? I didn't want a cuff. I didn't want a kiss. I wanted nice, normal methods of communication. How about a cell phone?
No towers in Fairy.
I narrowed my eyes. Did you just make a joke?
You walk amongst the worst of my kind, yet tremble at the prospect of a simple kiss.
I'm not trembling. See any trembling here? I thrust my trembling hands in my coat pockets and gave him a dead-level, cocky stare. I doubted anything from Blaine was simple, especially not a kiss. How about a mystical cell phone that doesn't use towers? I pressed. Surely with all that power you're so smug about, you can create...
Shut up, Michaela.
He grabbed a handful of curls at the back of my neck and yanked me toward him. I couldn't get my hands out of my pockets fast enough, so I slammed into his chest. I considered nulling him, but if he really was going to give me a way to contact him, I wanted it. It was part of my egg-diversifying plan. I wanted all the backup, potential weapons and odds in my favor that I could get. If I got into a jam again, like I'd been in beneath the Burrens, Blaine could save me in a matter of seconds. It had taken Barons hours to track me and get to me, following the beacon of my tattoo. Speaking of which... Blaine's knuckles grazed the base of my skull where Barons had branded me. His eyes narrowed, and he inhaled sharply. For a moment, he seemed to shimmer, as if he was struggling to hold form and not revert to another.
You think to allow his mark upon your body but refuse mine?
He hissed. He closed his mouth over mine. The Unseelie hunters are especially terrifying to she-seers because they know where we live inside our heads. They instinctively know exactly where to find the small, frightened child in us all. The Seelie princes know where we live, too, but it's the grown woman they're after. They hunt us in our own bodies, tracking us without mercy into the darkest corners of our libido. They seduce the Madonna. They celebrate the whore. They serve our sexual needs tirelessly, gorging on our passion, amplifying it, and slamming it back at us a thousandfold. They are masters of all our desires. They know the limits of our fantasies. They take us to the edge and leave us there, hanging by shredded fingernails above a bottomless gorge, begging for more. His tongue touched mine. Something hot and electric jolted through my mouth and pierced my tongue. It swelled inside me, filling my mouth. I choked on it and orgasmed instantly, as hot and electrifying as whatever he'd just done to my tongue. Pleasure ripped through me with such exquisite precision that my bones steamed and turned to water. I would have collapsed, but he took my weight, and I was in a dreamy, surreal place for a few moments, where his laughter was black velvet and his need was as vast as the night. Then I was clear and me again. There was something potent and dangerous in my mouth, on my tongue. How was I supposed to talk around it? He drew back.
Give it a moment. It will settle in.
It settled with all the subtlety of multiple orgasms on the cusp of a steel thorn, pleasure inseparable from pain. Aftershocks quaked through me. I glared at him, more shaken by his touch than I care to acknowledge. He shrugged.
I dampened myself greatly. It could have been much more...
What is your word?
Traumatic. Humans were not meant to carry a fae's name on their tongue. How does it feel, Michaela? You have a piece of me in your mouth. Would you like another?
He smiled, and I knew he didn't mean a word, or whatever it was that lay there coiled, slumbering but barely in a porcelain cage. When I was 14, I chipped a tooth in cheerleader practice. My dentist was on vacation, and it was nearly 2 weeks before I could get it fixed. During the interminable wait, my tongue incessantly worried the jagged edge of the enamel. That was how I felt now. I had an aberration in my mouth, and I wanted to scrape it out because it was wrong. It didn't belong there. And as long as it was on my tongue, I wouldn't be able to scrape the Fae Prince from my mind. It makes me want to spit, I said coolly. His face tightened, and the temperature plunged so sharply my breath frosted the night air.
I have honored you. I have never before given such a gift. Do not belittle it.
How do I use it?
Need me, open your mouth, and I will be there.
I didn't see him move, but suddenly his lips were against my ear.
Tell no one I gave it to you. Mention it, and I will take it away.
He vanished before he finished speaking. His words danced on the air like the Cheshire Cat's smile. Hey, I thought you wanted to know about the She's the Do. I was so startled by his abrupt departure that I spoke without thinking. I regretted it immediately. My words hung as heavy as Georgia humidity in the night. She, Sadu, seemed to echo sibilantly, soughing on the night wind, racing the darkness to darker ears, and I suddenly felt as if I'd stamped a red X on myself. I had no idea where Vlaine had gone or why he'd disappeared so suddenly, but I decided I'd be wise to do the same myself. Before I could move, a hand closed on my shoulder.
I do, Miss Lane,
Baron said grimly.
But first I'd like to know what the fuck you are doing kissing him.
Chapter 4. I turned, scowling. Baron's has a habit of popping up, without warning, when I least expect it, at the most inconvenient times. I absorbed him in slow degrees, the only way to look at him. As a whole, he's jarringly present in the space he occupies, as if 10 times the man occupies a normal man-sized space. I wonder why. Because there's an unseely stuffed inside him? I wonder how old he really is. I should be afraid of him. And sometimes in the middle of the night when I'm alone and I think about him, especially when I picture him carrying the dead woman's body and the look on his bloody face, I am. But when he's standing in front of me, I'm not. I wonder if it's possible for a person to do some kind of numbing spell, create a glamour so complete that it deceives all the senses, even she-seer ones. There's something on your lapel. I dabbed at it. He's also meticulous, never a man to sport lint or stains on his clothes. But tonight his dark suit had a shiny spot on the left side. I was dabbing at a man, for lack of a better word, who's had birthdays untold and walked in unseelie hallas, carrying around corpses. It felt as absurd as brushing a wolf's teeth or trying to moose his fur. And I wasn't kissing him. And I'd like to know what the feck you were doing with that woman in the mirror, I thought. But I didn't say it. There's a legal term my dad likes to use. Res ipsa loquitur. The thing speaks for itself. I knew what I knew,
and now I was watching him, and my back, very carefully. He knocked my hand away.
Then why was his tongue in your mouth? Was he conducting a clinical test of your gag reflex?
He smiled, but not nicely.
How is your gag reflex, Miss Lane? Are you a hair trigger?
Barons likes to use sexual innuendo to try to shut me up. I think he expects the well-raised southern belle in me will think, ew, and back off. Sometimes I do think ew, but I don't back off. I'm a spitter, if that's what you're asking. I flashed him a too sweet smile.
Didn't look that way to me. I think you're a swallower. His tongue was halfway to China, and you were still taking it.
Jealous?
Implies emotional investment. The only investment I have in you is my time, and I'm expecting a big payoff. Tell me about the shisadu.
I glanced at my hand. It had come away from his lapel wet. I angled it in the light. Red looks black at night. I sniffed it. It smelled like old pennies. Gee, blood. No surprise there. Have you been in a fight? No, let me guess. You saved a wounded dog again, I said dryly. That was the excuse he'd used last time.
I had a nosebleed.
Nosebleed my petunia.
Petunia?
Ass, Barons. As in you are one?
The book, Miss Lane.
I looked into his eyes. Was there a gripper in there? Something very old looked back. There's nothing to tell.
Why did you call after him?
I haven't seen him since the last time we saw the book. I keep Blaine informed. You're not the only shark in the sea. He raked me with a contemptuous glance.
It's a fey prince's fundamental nature to enslave a woman with sex, Miss Lane. It's a woman's fundamental nature to be enslaved. Try to rise above it.
Oh, it is not a woman's fundamental nature to be enslaved. Every woman reared up in me, battle ready. He turned and walked away.
You wear my brand, Miss Lane,
floated over his shoulder.
And if I'm not mistaken, you now wear his.
Who owns you?
I don't think it's you.
It is too! I yelled at his retreating back, but he was already halfway down the street, vanishing into the darkness. I don't wear his brand! Did I? Exactly what had Blaine embedded in my tongue? I fisted my hands, staring after him. Behind me, militant footfalls approached. I reached instinctively for my spear. It was back where it was supposed to be, holstered beneath my arm again. I needed to figure out how Blaine was taking it. Had he returned it when he had kissed me? Wouldn't I have felt it? Could I persuade Barons to ward so it couldn't be taken from me? He seemed to have a vested interest in my having it. A troop of ugly, gray-skinned rhino boys marched by, and I busied myself digging in my purse, partly to keep from watching them, counting their numbers, and trying to decide if they were new in town or if I'd seen them before, and partly to keep my face concealed in shadow. I wouldn't be at all surprised if the Lord Master was circulating a wanted poster of me with a detailed sketch. It was probably time to change my hair again, start wearing ball caps or wigs.
This is the end of disc number 2. Please insert disc number 3.